I've won every battle, yet somehow I'm losing the war. Welcome to the White Book Podcast, the original A Game of Thrones LCG podcast. Founded in 2010 as Two Champs and a Chump, we decided to rebrand ourselves and relaunch at the same time the game did with a second edition. Each week we bring you a new dose of strategy, insight, and all-around geeky goodness. A huge thank you to Fantasy Flight Games, George R. Mart, and our patrons and fans. This wouldn't be possible without you. We have huge plans, and this year we get to enact those. We are going to be co-hosting Game of Thrones Nationals. Learn more at agotnationals.com. Also check out the community site at agot.cards, where you can find tons of community content and an event listing system.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the White Book. I'm Aaron Glazer.
I'm Roy Rogers.
And I'm Will Lentz. And our patron winner this week that gets one of these sweet White Book magnets is Patrick Day. Congrats.
And Will depressed us, so you just got our whole intro cut.
It's true. That was a, like, for real quote, as my students would say. So it's a very sad one. What episode number is this,
Will?
This
is 338, if I'm counting correctly.
I think this is, like, got to be close to, like, well, like 100 episodes since I've been, like, an official White Book host. Because it was, like, yeah.
Weren't you on episode 200?
Yeah, I was going to say, it's got to
no,
be longer than
was
that.
Was I on episode 200?
You were on episode 200. Like, you guys probably, like, I did the Martell. Some of the first episode I appeared on was the Martell set review, which is really funny to think about the corset, me reviewing corset Martell cards. And then the big one that we did was 222 together, the three of us, that we took like a month to record, which I did in like three different bathrooms and then freezing outside of my parents' house.
I forgot about that part.
Yeah, that was really funny. I was just like laying in my parents' front lawn in October because the cell phone reception was so bad in their house, recording the episode. And then like a couple months later, like I was a couple other episodes when Kyle or Tommy couldn't make it, and then you officially made me one, like I think in March of that year. But you took that like 6 week, 7 week break. For your wedding, right?
Wait, you weren't your regular. Wait, you weren't a regular host by Two Champs and a Chump.
No, I was only post White Book. I was. You were a regular host, but I was not on Two Champs.
I mean, I was gonna say I knew.
I was the first non Midwesterner, and now like the cast is run by New Yorkers.
Yeah.
New Yorkers.
Man, I let one of you guys on, and you just flood the whole place.
I mean. I remember the first time I listened to a Two Champs and a Chump episode was coming back from PAX East 2013, even before I played the game seriously. I was like, oh, there's this podcast on this game that I just bought. And I listened to it, and Aaron was on it. It was like Aaron was yelling about the meta with Tommy, and Kyle was doing dishes.
Oh, that doesn't really narrow it down much.
That could be literally any episode of Two Champs and a Chump.
I don't remember what they were yelling specifically about, but that's the distinct thing. It was like Aaron would make some point in a very Aaron way, and Tom would be like, well, Aaron, and then there'd be this like...
as, you came back before.
Kyle did his dishes, which was pretty funny.
Those are the dark days.
Hey, in fairness, I joined the podcast mostly by yelling at Daryl to do shots.
There you go.
Like I yelled at Daryl to do shots so much that they started mentioning that on the podcast, and before I knew it, I was a host.
That's how it happens.
Yeah. So
I mean, this podcast made me a lot of friends. If Wama and I are friends because of this podcast.
Oh yeah, back when he would respond and tell us how wrong we were.
Oh
yeah,
and I got a message from Wama. Did I hear correctly that you're ready for the Rookery to go away? Yes, Wama. Yes, I am.
Wait, you and James agreeing? Oh my God, that's that truly means that the plague, that's the first plague of the end of the world, of the apocalypse. James Walmsley, Aaron Glazer agreeing.
You know what's another sign of the apocalypse, actually? At least I'm pretty certain. I'm going to say it's that FFG actually has made a few, in my mind, pretty solid choices in regards to OP prizes they've announced lately. We already kind of talked about...
Will?
Yes?
Before we talk about these awesome prizes that you're going to be giving out at U.S. Nationals, I really think another sign of the apocalypse is how well you transitioned there. That was smooth as
I saw it coming. I was like, oh, shit, is it going to work?
Yep. We tried. We had to backpedal a little bit to acknowledge it. But you know what? I'll take it. It's many years of practice trying to get to that point. Finally pulled it off once. We'll see what happens next time. But regardless.
But the next thing, it'll be a disaster.
Yeah, exactly. As long as I don't come up with any more depressing quotes, maybe we'll be okay. Maybe. Now I'm depressed again. So to cheer myself up.
No, you shouldn't be depressed, Will, because you, honest to goodness, the year that they decide to give you U.S. Nationals, they also decide to have the best prize support of any Nationals. Remember in Origins, was it Origins or Gen Con in the launch year that had the air fresheners?
I think that was Origins. I don't really remember seeing them at Gen Con.
Could have been both.
I was not at Origins, so I'm just guessing.
So, because I remember they also double dipped that year with prize support. So,
yeah,
it was bad. Yeah. So,
I think that was the Origins year because I think that was one of the complaints from a lot of people that they were not different prizes for Nationals.
So, it was bad.
Yeah.
But Ryan Ritter and his crew have really knocked it out of the park and brought a lot of awesome stuff. What do we have, Will? If we come to Missouri in September, what are we going to get?
In September, Labor Day weekend. If folks are interested, go check out www.agotnationals.com. But anyway, so the article here throws several things on us. They're throwing a top 64 Milk of the Poppy alt art, top 32 dual-sided spot gloss agendas, Conclave and the Reigns of Castamere. Top 16 Bolton tokens. Top 8. Let's see which wildling is this? This one's Val. Yeah, I always want to get her and Dala mixed up. Top 4 gives us a wooden Stark Mormont house card, and then both finalists get entry to Worlds and sweet Marjorie trophy for the winner. So. Seems pretty cool. I like it. But it does already prompt a couple questions. So I'm gonna voice the questions and then come back to what I like. So question number one is, it doesn't mention a participation prize, just the top 64 Milk of the Poppy. So I wonder if that was meant to be participation and was a goof in the article, or if there's not a participation or what. I don't know.
So I think I can answer that question. So recently at these bigger tournaments, FFG has not been giving a participation prize.
Oh, no.
They like Gen Con last year, the card was not a participation prize. It was a top 64.
There you go.
I did not remember that. Wow. Well, good.
I'm pretty sure at least.
Now you know, and knowing is half the battle.
And technically, the regional prizes aren't participation prizes. They're like top 64. But I mean, of course, like there hasn't been a regional with 64 people since like what, the launch of 2.0?
Yeah, I was about to say maybe ever, but yeah, there probably were some launch year of 2.0.
There was a 70-person Connecticut regional the year that the game launched. Okay. But yeah, I don't think anything's reached that point. I mean, we were the biggest with 50-something at Dance last year in North America. So, I mean, excuse me, we need to be clear. We're just talking about North America here, right? Europe still has regionals that are 70-plus people. So I think that's just what they do, is they just say, hey, we're going to give you enough prize support to cover 64 people. It should be everybody, but if you're not in that top 64, good luck.
Mm-hmm. Which is kind of a bummer, because I would probably play the Smoke of the Poppy. Like, you know, now they're actually choosing cards that I am likely to play, unlike some past choices. So it's kind of a bummer that these aren't, you know, store kit prizes or something.
Well, you can just go to Worlds and win them on the prize wall, Will.
If I can make it to Worlds this year, fingers crossed. Using up a lot of AK this year.
Yeah, tell me about it.
Oh, go ahead.
No, I was just going to add, I'm also taking a lot of AK this year, so we're in similar boats.
Mm-hmm. The other thing that I kind of question here is that the finalists, you know, it mentions that you earn a free seat at the World Championship as a finalist, and then it mentions the trophy for the winner, and you get a bye to the World Championship, but it doesn't mention travel. Didn't they get travel previously?
I believe they did. I know Platt was promised some, who's the current, I think, only national champion right now is Jake Platt, the Canadian national champion. I think he was promised some vague sense of, like, maybe a hotel room or something, but I know the last time I spoke to him about it, it was very unclear. But I think I'm going to see Jake this upcoming weekend at Kubla. If not, I'm going to see Hansen. I can ask Nick Hansen, but, I think it's not really clear what FFG is doing to support people from national champions. I think it's up to the distributor in Europe. So even, you know, they get the kit from FFG. If, you know, I don't know. For some reason, I used to know what the British distributor is, but it's escaping me at the moment. Like, if they decide, hey, we're going to pay for this national champion, they get to go.
Was the British one is Divium, something like that?
Yeah, it's something like that, yeah.
Well, at the time of recording, we don't have any answer to this, but I think I'll also reach out to FFG, see if I can ply them with sweet words and the fact that we're running the U.S. Nationals, and see if we can get a hard answer of some kind on that and disseminate that to folks. So we'll see what we can do. On the plus side, though, I really want to end by saying that I love that Reigns of Castamere art. My favorite Lannister art in the game. Or maybe that has been in the game, I should say.
Yeah, it's really good. And the Bolton tokens are, like, amazing.
Very cool. I like the different...
Yeah, I'm super impressed, like...
Oh. Nope, keep going.
Oh, it just makes me really glad I'm going to Nationals, so...
Mm-hmm. Glad they're stepping it up.
Yeah, it's the Will Lentz quality.
Yeah, exactly.
It's causing him to step it up.
We'll just chalk up all the OP wins to me. I like the sound of that.
I'm okay with that. You and Ryan can have all the credit.
Tell you what, let's keep rolling this episode. I thought for a minute, and I couldn't come up with a good enough transition that time. I know. But
it's okay, Will.
We'll see if we can go ahead and hit a topic for this week other than the news. And one topic that I had kind of been thinking about is to kind of have another kind of general strategy session and just talk a little bit, kind of freeform, about playing from behind and how you deal with that, how you kind of try to mentally prepare yourself, how you kind of try to claw back into the game and that sort of thing. Because, you know, playing when you're ahead, that's the easy part. You just keep doing what you're doing. You just continue to win the game. Changing a losing position to a winning one, that's the hard part.
Is it? I mean, I feel like I play almost entirely Martell, so I play from behind a lot. I feel like most of what you do playing from behind, unless you have literally zero power in your house, in which case part of what you're doing is just not generating power, I feel like a lot of what you're doing is just not panicking and continue to play your game. Like, if your deck can do what it's supposed to, you'll be fine. Just keep playing and stay consistent. Like, changing strategies because you're behind tends to lose you the game that you would otherwise still be in.
Yeah, I think, I mean, there's two perspective, or not two perspectives, there's two, like, way times you can find yourself playing from behind, right? One is, like Aaron said, like the Martell stay, where your deck consciously, or Night's Watch Wolf, that, like, you're usually those early turns, your deck, the way your deck just plays puts you behind, right? And then there's times when you fall terminally behind and you're playing, like, a mid-range deck, or you're playing a rush deck, or some deck that has a much more proactive strategy, and then you end up falling behind. I think what Aaron's describing is sort of the, I guess, the easier one to wrap your mind around, because the deck's game plan is like built. You go in knowing, okay, my first turn is not going to be this amazing turn where I play Khal Drogo and play Dany and burn all your stuff. It's, you know, I know I'm going to take it slow and steady and grind them out.
I don't,
while other decks,
think that's the case. Like with Martell Wolf,
it'd be more nerve wracking.
With Martell Wolf, my general plan is to fuck up your whole world by turn like two. Like, by the first couple turns, like, I should already be set up and ready to, like, win the game. Like, I'm not really playing from behind with Martell unless something's gone wrong and I'm not seeing my pieces. I don't think Second Edition is built as a game. I guess maybe some, like, extremely stally stuff. But, like, in general, is built as a game where you can afford to do that consistently. There's too many fast decks, there's too many strong decks that can just rock you if that's how you're planning on winning the game. Like, I don't think the better Martell, like, that's why I don't especially like HRD Starfall. Why I think it's a fun deck, I don't think it's especially T1, because I don't think in this meta you can afford to play a deck that plans to fall behind that way. You need to be constantly improving your position in a way that doesn't allow. I mean, like, the only thing Martell does, or one of the major things Martell does that makes the long game better than the short game, is just draw well.
Mm-hmm.
Like, having cards and thus having stuff you can do is really, I mean, duh, is really important for the long game. It's why Tyrell, despite being nominally a rush mid-range deck like you're talking about, is something that can play from behind so well. It's something that doesn't care about that so well, because it's going to continually get cards. And as long as you continually get cards and have a real game plan, you'll be fine.
Right. I think you have a good point there. And I do think one of the things, actually, I think the strongest Tyrell decks besides the balls to the wall rush deck right now in the meta are ones that don't care what happens generally. I mean, in the first two or three turns, that they have a clear game plan and that they're initially just trying to stop you from what you're doing, you know, and then get to the point where, okay, it's safe for me to play Mace and then close out pretty quickly.
Right.
And so, yeah.
Good.
And you just maintain card advantage to keep you in the game, even though you're nominally behind, even though your opponent could be at 9 power or 10 power at the end of turn 3, but you know you're going to go Mace, go from maybe 3 power to 12 and then win before marshalling.
I think maybe those, like, two different scenarios you're thinking of, Roy, or that you kind of expressed that Aaron's thinking of, right? The decks that are playing from behind early on purpose versus those that have fallen behind, so to speak. I think maybe there might be a unifying kind of connection there. Mainly, I was thinking of the topic at first as just being when you've fallen behind. And I was thinking about really a lot of my advice there boils down to buying yourself time. Time is your friend. Not the round time, not the actual countdown to your 55 minutes or whatever tournament, but the in-game time, right? Your number of plots or whatever. Everyone always talks about going to, you know, 2 plots, 4 plots, 12 plots, whatever it is, rather than real world time. And mm-hmm. when you've fallen behind, I think a lot of times you are trying to slow things down, slow the pace back down so you can buy yourself additional time, additional turns. But the thought that occurs to me here to kind of connect that, when you guys are talking about, you know, particularly Tyrell with that draw, but also Martell's later game draw, is that your ability then to draw back up more cards, get that additional advantage, that those additional resources there, is effectively just compressing time, right? You are, instead of trying to drag that game out at that point when you've already started behind, you don't want to drag it out even further to try to catch back up. You're compressing all of that draw up, well, not up front, but into shorter moments to try and get yourself back up into that hump to turn it, to drop your mace and close out the game or whatever it might be.
I mean, not in some houses, right? Like, Tyrell is unique in that they want to go quickly at the end. Like, in Martell or a Night's Watch Wolf or whatever else, like, any deck along those lines, you're not closing quickly just because, like, the game's gone long. I mean, I guess playing behind is just, like, and what I mean by playing behind is just playing good Thrones. It's defend what you can, figure out what you can lose without hurting your ability to strike back. Going second is a lot more important generally when you're behind, too. And figuring out, like, how much I need to defend in order to, like, sort of maintain stasis while I wait for the shift. And if you can't get a shift, you're just going to lose. And I don't think you can get a shift without lucky draw from something like card draw. Like, right? Like, unless you top deck exactly what you need, which is unlikely, you need draw, which is why Stark is traditionally such a completely terrible mid to late game deck.
Absolutely. I think to build on what you're saying there, Glazer, and to build on what Will's saying, I think we need to clarify sort of two categories of what we're talking about. One is like decks that structurally play from behind to run their opponent out of their game plan or threats, however you want to phrase it. And then when you fall strategically behind in the individual plays because of the draw of your deck or the draw of your opponent's deck or a misplay that you made that cost you the tempo that you needed to stay ahead, right? Because I think there are two, like one is a game plan, deck building, big strategy playing from behind, which I think is what we've been talking a lot about. And then there's the tactical falling from behind, which I think is easier to be pithy about, like it just play better Thrones, but is also more important for people to
behind.
I wasn't throwing shade at you when I said that. I'm saying, like, I was thinking about in my head, like, what would I say to someone who, you know, you fall behind tactically? What do you do? And I was thinking about my own games. And for me, the number one thing is, like, don't get discouraged, because that just leads to more misplays, more digging yourself into a hole, more. Like, I lost a game at Thrones War to Chris Schoenthal entirely because I let myself get just discouraged because he was Baylon-ing me to death. And,
well, it's like the term or saying or whatever about going on tilt, right? Mm-hmm. I would say that discouragement sets you on tilt. You always wind up looking for what you fear. You're like priming all of your choices and decisions, what you're seeing on the game, into that negative light. And that I think if you can keep yourself from looking that way, at the game, you're more likely to play your way out of having fallen behind. If you're just looking that way, then you'll just keep on down that path.
How do you avoid tilt, Glazer?
I mean, I don't get tilted at all, basically ever. I don't know why you would. Like, you just play the game. Like, you play the cards you have, and you don't freak out. Like, if you see the cards you need, you'll do great. Like, I've lost in the cut of major tournaments to, like, really annoying top decks, but, like, sometimes there's nothing you can do. It's just you play the cards you have. Like, there's literally, like, the only thing that really annoys me is when I make major mistakes, and I tend to make, like, a couple. Like, now I'm like, oh, man, I should have just really played that plot there. That would have won me the game. Sometimes that happens fairly often to basically everyone. But, like, that, like, major, oh, my God, I should have triggered blah happens to me once or twice a tournament, and, like, that'll annoy me. But, like, it annoys me more after the game than during the game. During the game, just, like, here's the cards in front of me, and, like, there is no past. There's only what we can do from here on out. The only thing that matters in the past is in determining how it limits future options. Like, do I have to worry about, like, if I've seen a marched and I know this deck isn't running too marched, that's the only reason I really care that, like, that marched happened. It happened, and worrying about that it happened doesn't affect anything. Those cards are now discarded.
It's true. I once entirely first turn wiped Aaron Glazer's board at a tournament. Then he was like, oh, that's a good play. And I, in the very first plot of that tournament game, Aaron's entire board playing Baromaesters was entirely wiped out in first edition, and he couldn't do anything that first turn. If I was in Glazer's seat still today, would have been tilted and lost that game. But Aaron came around and beat me in a long, grindy game from that point.
I mean, that's just in my heart of hearts, I guess, that's just how Thrones works. Thrones doesn't, like, some people really like Rush, some people really like Stall, some people like, to me, the way Thrones works is, like, it's a series of microtransactions that are always moving forward, and, like, I don't need to win every microtransaction, I need to come at it, like, the quote Will used at the beginning, I don't need to win battles, I'm trying to win the war, and nothing, like, I've come back from 14 down, 14-0 countless times, because, like, 14 power isn't anything. 14 power doesn't win the game. It's just a pretty number.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is right there on the edge of a specific thought that I kind of had when I picked out that quote, having to do with power, like you're saying, and all of the individual battles, if you will. You might look at some of those as being individual challenges, and I think sometimes, especially newer players, get too set on winning everything, whether that's defense or offense or both. But I think looking at them carefully and trying to figure out which challenges buy you that greater amount of time when you're defending, and which ones earn you a greater incremental advantage on attack, is pretty important. You know, knowing which ones you can lose, you can go ahead and sacrifice so that you can win the war. Even if that's a sacrifice play, just as a chump defender to slow down their power gain. You know, if they're at 14, they haven't won yet.
Yeah, when you're behind, it's often very pointless to even bother making military challenges.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you're behind, their board is usually better than yours to the point where, like, if you're trading military challenges, the game's over, because you're never going to affect anything that matters to them through sheer military challenges. With the exception of if you're running something like Doharis and you want to get rid of a couple cheap guys so they only have big guys left for you to Doharis. But, like, short of that, like, you might as well just stick around with those for defense or to try and win Dom or whatever else. Intrigue limits options because eventually the game resets, and power when you're behind basically slows them down and keeps the game in stasis until you get there. But, like,
yeah,
just Thrones again. Like, right? Like, there's like six resets in the game. That's very often going to be the case.
I definitely want to go back around to something you've both have been saying, though, that is really hard for me to remember that when I'm behind, particularly if I'm like really behind, is that the only power that matters is the 15th. And you need to keep that in mind when you're behind,
With one exception. What? So the 14th power matters an awful lot if you are having trouble winning dominance.
That's true.
Like, because I'll often try and keep the opponent at 13.
That's true.
If 13 will become my magic number if I realize I'm not going to be winning dominance much going forward. Like, because I don't care. Like, I genuinely just, like, don't care how much power you get as a general rule. A lot of renown is frustrating. If you can get, like, 5 or 6 in a turn, I obviously have to care, right? But if you're doing the grindy power game, I generally only care about 14 to 15. Unless I can't win dominance, then 13 to 14 becomes real important. And, you know, sometimes that loses you games because they top decked or they saw whatever they needed. But more often than not, ..
Yeah. The other thing that I think is easy to mistake, to make a mistake I make all the time when playing from behind, is forgetting that your goal is to win. So sometimes you can get into a situation when you're playing from behind where you just focus on sort of stopping your opponent's game plan, and that's literally all you're trying to do, instead of trying to figure out how stopping your opponent's game plan will get you to the outs that you have to actually win the game. And that's a situation that I ran into, again, to go back to the game I mentioned earlier with Chris Schoenthal at Thrones War, which is like, I'm getting Balon. He's doing 2 challenges, get 2 renown. Like, how am I going to get out of this situation? And just like trying to stop those challenges. And that's it. I didn't do the math because I was focused only on that, because I was feeling so far behind that if I had done the math, I would have known, hey, if I do A, B, and C instead of X, Y, and Z, I will be at 14 and he'll be at 13 power when time is called at the end of this round. But I was so focused solely on trying to survive because I was behind that I didn't look to my outs. So another thing that when you fall tactically behind is, while definitely making sure you grind out, making sure that you keep that either equal card advantage or plus card advantage, you need to remember that you also need to play to your outs. What is your deck's game plan and how can you get back on it? And not just stopping what your opponent's doing if they're running over you.
I have that major problem. Like, that was a lot of our advice at war, was like, hey, grind it out, take your time. If you go to time, you go to time, just be ahead on power, yada, yada, yada. I've gone to time, I think, in 1 Thrones game ever. So, like, I'm incapable of going to time. I just play too fast. So that just doesn't work for me.
You do play very fast and very sloppy.
Yeah.
Not in your, like, technical trigger play, but in your, like,
I just throw cards. Also, you've seen me lose by playing that super grindy game fairly recently. Remember that opponent in the Throne Techie tournament game who top decked the stupid I had his hand.
The secret.
Yeah, I had his hand and board to basically nothing. He top decked a secret scheme on plot 6. And drew enough and then won. And I was just like, oh, well.
All right. Well, yeah, this game is.
I don't love super swingy stuff like that, like, in the game as a whole, right? Because that doesn't reward technical play, and that's what I want the game to reward at its core, which is, you know, like, if you break down all my desires from the restricted list to everything else, it's like, I want to reward more technical play. I want to reward people who, like, build the right deck for the meta, think it through, and don't need to be lucky. And, like, Thrones does not seem to be going that way, but, like, if you play that way, playing from behind's not a problem. Except variance is an issue because, you know,
it's a card game. I definitely want to agree with you there, Glazer. Another thing is to have faith in your deck. It's
unless
oftentimes
you are playing Clansmen without the second building orders because you look to CT and Jesse.
Yes. Anyway, besides that, have faith in your deck. Like, you brought that deck for a reason. It does a certain thing. And know that if you remember what its outs are, remember what its game plan is, you can get there. And, like, the times when I've successfully played from behind, like, I'm thinking about a game that I played against Sandy at the tournament that I won in Boston. Winds of Winter this year. Like, he got the jump on me. He had, like, all this crazy location removal. He got, you know, Asha going on the first turn. He got Euron out. And it was like, oh, my God, I'm playing a wall deck and there's Euron. And I remember it's like, look, I know what my deck's game plan is. I need, these are the cards I need from my deck. How can I get these cards from my deck? How can I get to the game plan that I want? And once I literally took like a deep breath in that moment and was like, okay, this is my game plan. I need, in this situation, I need to dig for a milk, not for the wall. I need to prepare, set myself up for a reset because that Asha doesn't have a dupe and his hand is relatively thin because he's been chucking cards to stand Asha a bunch of times. So it's highly unlikely he has that Risen. So if I can get to the point where Euron's not going to steal my locations and I can reset, then I'm in a good spot. And that's how the game went, right? So because I had faith in my deck in that moment, even though I was like, if you were watching that game, you would have been like, Roy, sorry, Will, that you're going to have to censor that. Like, but like, and that's how I felt in the back of my mind. But I took that deep breath and I remembered, like, I had faith in my deck. I brought builders to that meta for a reason and it ended up paying off. But that, like, probably the lowest moment in the tournament for me was in that game, because that was probably the furthest behind. Even the one game I lost that day, I was never that far behind as I was in that Sandy game at that moment. And even Sandy said after the game, he was like, you really played your outs and flipped it. And yeah. So just remember and have confidence in your deck and remember that you brought it for a reason and you practiced with it, hopefully.
That you brought it for a reason? I mean,
assuming you brought it for a reason, assuming you practiced with it, both of those are assumptions, right? Like, Bruno got a card design with he had no practice with.
Yeah, I mean, like, half the world champions won with decks they built the night before or something like that?
Yeah, Sam Bratz had never seen his deck before with his first world championship.
Good time.
It's true, but they brought that deck for a reason. Sam could have faith in the deck, right?
Yeah, Sam didn't bring it for a reason. Sam brought it because they gave it to him, right?
Well, they gave it to Sam. Is that a better way to put it? Like, it wasn't like Sam grabbed 7 Direwolf cards and was like, hey, I'm playing this deck.
He did
now.
It war and was King of Swords.
Nah, he brought that deck for a reason to Worlds. He brought it less for a reason, I think, at War, but he definitely brought it for a reason at Worlds. So, yeah.
I mean, if you're going to be behind also, like, if you realize that you're falling behind, try really hard not to reset early.
Yeah.
Like, because once your reset's gone, if they can just reflood on plot 2, you are just completely screwed.
You're more screwed, like, than when you started out.
Yeah, because now you no longer have an out. And unfortunately, this is Scott's big complaint, and one I agree with, though less vehemently than he does. They also, but they're waiting on that reset gives them more of an opportunity to top deck dupes.
Yeah, that's if you're, particularly if your reset is Valor or Harris, right? Valor Morghulis,
and that is the best reset in the game. Now that we actually have economy for almost Morghulis? Every house, yeah. Like, if you're running a reset, it should, it has to, like, the Harris's existence, like, changes the way you have to play the game a little bit until you know what reset your opponent has, but like, it should probably usually be Morghulis.
Depends on the deck.
Usually, like, for the majority, not for all. Like Tyrell, Greyjoy, Martell, Targaryen. Targaryen go either way. And Baron never wants Valor, right? Morghulis.
Tyrell ideally wants both.
Yeah.
Reset.
But that's hard to do.
I know, but when he can do it, though, it's quite brutal. I had another. Oh, yeah. One of the things that I haven't been able to figure out actually recently in second edition was one of the iron rules of first edition that's still in the back of my brain. Excuse me. Is that, like, turn 2 Valors unless you're playing against a rush deck that can win turn two, is a loss 90% of the time. I don't think that's the case in second edition, though. Like, I've gone back and forth. There's games where I've been like, oh, a turn two Valor is, like, I can't get over the results-oriented impression of like, turn two Valors as an act when you're playing from behind. Because, like, sometimes I do it and it's like, oh, mana from heaven, it's lovely. Other times I've been like, oh, I shouldn't have done that. I should have waited a few more turns. But sometimes when I wait that few more turns, they then top deck the dupe on the Asha. And I'm like, oh, okay, you got Asha, you got it with the dupe and the Iron Mines. And it's just like, okay, Valor doesn't do shit.
So,
I haven't
what's your economy?
Figured out.
How important are these characters to their deck? Are they just wide? Or are you getting, like, two of the three main characters in the deck? Like, sometimes you have to Valor and they're going to save something. Do you have a plan to get rid of that thing they're going to save? That's where a card like Venomous Blade is especially valuable, right? Like, if you can time your Valor, if without a ton of economy on their side, if you can time their your Valor to their counting, you're in a reasonably good position. Like, at that point, assuming you have decent economy, like, they're not going to be able to play that much more. You can then Venomous or something, that whatever they play, and now you're set up for a Marched. Or cheapo burn, or whatever the case may be, depending on what you're playing. Ward. Whatever that, the recruiter from Night's Watch. Like, these are the key cards. Yeah, these are the key cards for, like, if you're planning on playing from behind, right? Like, otherwise, if you're playing from behind, your win percentage is just going to be lower because your deck isn't built to optimize that. Generally speaking, though, it probably should be built to optimize something like occasionally having to play from behind. It should be built so that that isn't an automatic loss because, like, setup variance is still a thing. And there's not really a solution to that except build for it, build with that in mind, build with the assumption that, like, you might draw poorly and thus you're going to need to have a plan for when this happens.
Yeah, I mean, Thrones is still not a best of three match game, like something like Magic. So you can't just eat that lost game while you were behind and then hope to get ahead and stay ahead in, you know, games two and three and win the match to proceed. Like, there will be rounds where you fall behind with normal here in air quotes decks, ones that are not planning on starting behind and playing that up. But, you know, those normal decks are going to have to prepare for that situation because, you know, that's your only option when you're playing in the turn.
And with two other exceptions, I guess. One is if you're building and playing with a team. If you're building and playing with a team, you guys can all just assume that one or two of you are going to take those unlucky losses, and then the one or two of you that don't, and then your team ends up successful. And, like, who really cares that, like, that didn't especially work out for, you know, one or two people that are on the group?
That can definitely change the math, for sure.
The other thing is, thing besides draw that can really help you, which helps Tyrell, which is part of what makes Tyrell so insane, and helps Greyjoy, is saves. So that when you do have to reset and come back, you're already doing it from a stronger board position. Like, if you just have more on the board, you're in a better shape than your opponent who no longer does. And Lady in Waiting and the 18,000 Greyjoy saves are how you basically do that, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, Tyrell being the house that has draw and saves and gold is really well positioned to play from behind.
So, building on the discussion, Will, was it like a year ago that the three of us, you, me, and Luke, did the episode about Quadrant Theory?
Yeah, probably thereabouts.
Thinking about when we're working in this quadrant and playing from behind, what is the single best card when you're behind, to have to top deck or to have in your hand when you're behind.
Single
or in your plot deck, to be clear. Ooh. Best, thinking about it.
Well, I mean,
what card?
That's so context dependent.
I'm torn here, but especially
I'm asking you to be specific.
Especially when Roy mentions top decking and then mentions in your plot deck. Like, to me, those are two very separate categories for this type of thing, because how you plan and use and interact with that is way different, especially when you're behind. I mean, like, in deck, what would I most want to top deck when I'm behind? Honestly, maybe a pleasure barge, so I can draw three and just get that, like, card quantity, and hopefully the aggregate, like, quality of that is enough to give me some outs.
I know my answer.
But in plot deck, I think it's different, and you wind up looking at some variety of reset. I think Valor Margolis is probably my choice at the moment, but...
That should have told you what character you want. You want the character Valor.
the character Valor. The old first ed Red Viper?
Varus.
Oh, that one.
You want
Varus.
Well,
you know, if I draw a Pleasure Barge, maybe I can hit a Varus on the three more cards I see.
I'd rather just draw the Varus than hope for the best with Pleasure Barge.
Sure.
Like, if I'm behind and I need to top deck, like, that's, like, I would just, like assuming I have economy, and if you're behind and you don't have economy, the game's over. Like, the way second edition is built. Like, you're behind with no economy, have a nice day.
Yeah, I guess the economy was kind of inherent in my choice of Pleasure Barge, since I'm sacking future economy.
Well, if you're, like, in fact, when you're criminally behind, I think in second edition, top decking two limited cards is literally the worst thing in the world. So, but for me, actually, it's besides a character, it's Nightmares. I actually think Nightmares is a really strong card when you're behind, because it gives you that, like, turn. It gives you one more turn, right? Like, being able to turn off their Robert, being able to turn off their Danny, being able to preserve your board space, you know, turn off their wall. Or mace or whatever for that one turn, like, just taking that one power that puts them at 13 rather than 14 is just, like, such a huge thing. Nightmares just is so flexible. It can, you know, it can sometimes let you flip the game. It could be like, oh, all I need right here is to be able to shut down Robert's strength pump this turn. I can push through a power challenge and, you know, kneel their red keep, and they won't draw any cards, and then I can reset next turn. Like, there's just, like, I think the most context-free good card when you're behind is Nightmares.
I think it's Varus still.
It's a reasonable one.
No, I think so.
I mean, it, like, unless you're playing against Targ, then I guess I'd rather have Nightmares. But, like, it's probably Varus for me. Which is weird, because I don't really run Varus in any decks.
Yeah, you haven't really won Varus since you won Red Saturday.
Yeah. I mean, I ran him here, there, after. It's just Varus doesn't really, like, I'm scared of Targ, right? Like, Targ is a rough matchup for Varus. Short of Targ, though, Varus is incredible. Varus is real good against Terrell.
Sometimes.
I mean, if you can Varus then reset, it's very annoying. Mm-hmm. Oh, also, Varus goes... Real, and I don't have a deck that does this. I'm assuming that deck is Night's Watch Wolf. But Varus goes real well with New Arya.
Props and Slops.
What was the last time we did one of these? It was the recording thing. What happened since then? Did I talk about Pillars of Eternity 2 in the last episode that we did?
That does not ring a bell offhand.
I've never heard of it, so.
Anyway, it's the sequel to Pillars of Eternity, and I am 75% done with it. I bought it as a semi-belated birthday present to myself. And Yeah, it's really good. Like, it's like, if you know anything, Pillars of Eternity is the kind of game that's in, the original one was inspired by those like classic computer role playing games like Baldur's Gate and Icewind Dale, and they had sold Pillars of Eternity 2 as being like Baldur's Gate 2, and actually it really does feel like that. It feels like, I didn't super love Pillars of Eternity 1, but I enjoyed it, and Pillars 2 takes the things I liked about Pillars 1 and just cranks those up, and takes most of the things I didn't like and cranks those down, so it's a really, really satisfying experience. So I will definitely prop that.
I've never heard of it, but I'm glad you like it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Man, I just...
I don't know if it's your cup of tea, Glazer.
I don't know how Roy finds all this time for video gaming. I'm honestly so jealous of it. You're always mentioning some new good one you've gotten the chance to play.
I just make the time, Will. I literally sacrifice other things. Like
being good at Thrones.
Yeah, like being good at Thrones.
Well, there we go. You know, if I sacrifice Thrones, I could fit in a lot of video gaming.
Also, Alla and I, like, Alla will play video games, like, what she's doing right now, while I play video games, so it's a very, like, semi-couple-y activity that we can do. So I'm gonna prop how amazing my fiancé is.
You know, there, that's always a good idea.
Love you, too.
Well done. Hopefully I'll get to meet her at some point.
Yeah. Sooner rather than later, I think.
Gen Con?
No, not Gen Con.
Okay, I didn't think so.
If I can step on another prop, though, I do want to prop all the Thrones people who have decided that they're going to come out for my bachelor party that is going to be at Gen Con this year. So I'm pretty excited about that.
Yeah.
Also, just so you guys are ready to prepare yourselves, the big party will be Friday night.
For Thrones, yeah.
For Thrones, the big Thrones party, right.
At Casablanca,
it's
like
gonna
always.
Be Friday night?
Friday night.
Isn't it normally Saturday?
Because the... Well, that's because... But the joust is Friday. Isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. This year. So it's usually after the joust. Okay.
So. Well, hey, that might be...
So, yeah, it'll be Friday. Because Melee's Saturday.
I think. Maybe. Could be. Sort of.
I think so. And so we're gonna blow the roof off this year. So, like, last year's was pretty amazing. Aaron was not there.
I was not. I was.
But it was one of the best ones. It was the second best one.
So it was the fourth best one because I went to three. Got it.
I don't know. Naj was saying it was better than most of the other ones. So I trust Dark Naj.
Really? Because he messaged me. Wasn't the same. Dan too.
Oh, you. It wasn't the same without you, but it was still really good.
Man, it sucked. All right. Did Will actually make it ever?
Possibly.
Yeah, Will made it 2 years.
Yeah. Okay. Well, because usually he goes, I have this other podcast party to go to with my highfalutin friends.
Hey, I mean...
And I'm going to ditch all
when,
my Thrones.
When they can have, like, an exclusive password-only party in the basement of the oldest bar in downtown Indy during Gen Con, like, that's pretty cool.
That is pretty cool.
None of that means anything to me.
Were you there the year, though, that Bruno and Kyle sang together in karaoke? Because that was good.
Yeah. No, he was not.
That was the year you weren't there.
That was a good year.
That was a good year. That was my first Gen Con.
Yep.
Yeah, that was the first time I met you, Will.
Good time.
Very briefly.
Keep going. You started to say cuz, and I accidentally cut you off.
Because you didn't play in the joust that year, right? Was that the year you didn't play in the?
You're right.
You played in like the Kingslayer.
Yeah, I forgot. I took 1 year off for some conflicting events. Yeah, I forgot about that.
Yeah, because I remember Aaron was like, "You should meet Will," and I was like, "Hi, Will," and then you were like, "I'm going off to do something else. Nice to meet you." And then we were reintroduced.
And then we drafted
world,
you to do a podcast
because you were the famous Will Lentz then. Yeah.
That was the last 1.0 Gen Con, right?
It was, yeah.
Yeah. Good job, Will.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I played at World, so it was...
No, that couldn't have been the last 1.0 Gen Con.
It was?
That couldn't have been 1.0 Gen Con. Because the last... No. Because the last... I'm pretty sure the last 1.0 Gen Con, we the White Book hosted the 2.0.
Yeah, it was the same year.
Same year, really?
You were so hungover, you couldn't. You played in one round and then went to went to sleep. I don't remember what you did at the Kingslayer tournament.
No, that is not what happened.
Oh, wait, breakfast.
I accidentally went. I thought we were going to like grab breakfast quickly and then go to Kingslayer, and they were like, "Yeah, we're not doing Kingslayer. We're just gonna get breakfast." And I was like, "Oh, okay." So I never made it. Like I was already in the card, like halfway to breakfast. I was like, "Well, I guess I'm going to breakfast."
Yeah.
So I ate breakfast and started drinking, because what else are you to do?
That's true.
That's crying over spilt milk, always moving forward.
It's true. Because I made the top 16 at the last Gen Con 1.0, so I...
And I did not.
Barely. You missed it on tiebreakers, if I remember right?
Yeah, I was 4-2, but that was the one where Dan beat me, which functionally eliminated me, and then almost cried.
Yeah.
Like, I'm going to drop. I was like, Dan, you're not dropping. Although, in hindsight, I probably should have just let him drop. I had a much better matchup in the cut.
Yeah, well, he made the top 8, so. But
yeah, but he had no shot against...
Jerry?
No, against Dragon Pit. Uh-huh. Like, he was going to run into a Dragon Pit eventually, and his deck was true. Like our whole... The whole reason that we didn't all take that deck is because, A, Dan was really good at piloting it. But B, it was absolutely terrible against Dragon Pit, and really not good against the Maesters deck, which was the other DC deck that year.
Yeah, that Simone played.
Yeah.
And rolled me in the cut. That was the year that Dark Nage drew 6 limited cards. Oof. And had a 1-card setup.
Yeah, and then still almost came back, except his opponent top deck to dupe. It's always fun.
So
That was the best deck at that tournament that year, but what are you going to do?
That's also the first time I saw Dark Nage beat someone on tiebreakers and cause them to cry. So
Not the last.
So I think every major tournament I've been at, that happens with John.
It is completely absurd that we still have, by the way, slops to FFG that cards in deck is still a tiebreaker. Because that remains the dumbest damn thing I've ever heard. And, like, everyone's like, it's not going to affect that much. And it affects the cut, like, in every major tournament. It's completely absurd.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, it's so easy to fix. And they just straight up are just like, nah, we don't care.
You got anything, Will? Like,
this week, I'm just going to pre-prop first player. And I'm going to slop getting ready for it. A lot of work goes into hosting events like this. Maybe that would be a good podcast topic. Like me, you, Roy, Kyle, like folks that maybe pull somebody from the West Coast in, like Ryan.
Jesse.
Oh, yeah. Jesse, duh. He just hosted a huge event. Yeah. Just talk about a lot of the behind-the-scenes work that goes into getting this stuff together.
Yeah, I love that. It's a very important and underappreciated skill to organize tournaments, so.
Yeah.
Oh, I had a thought. It's gone. Oh, well, go ahead.
I guess I should prop KubaCon, which I have not gone to yet, but I assume will be utterly lovely. So, good job, Sid.
For being utterly lovely, even though you can't be bothered to make Second Sons anymore.
He's only missed one episode.
Whatever.
Wasn't it like his anniversary? Or no, it was his like kids something? I don't know.
It was his excuses.
I don't know.
Hey, I'm going to prop the Second Son, which you can find on twitch.tv/JesuiBuzz. You can't spell that at all, but I promise it's a podcast about Thrones.
There we go.
Will's got to leave that.
I don't care Facebook. If you prop Second
Well, we're technically in the White Book family.
We are technically the White Book family. We started out as a White Book
fill-in.
Yeah.
Fill-in, yeah.
It started when you went on your post-wedding? Or was it? It was the year of the Will hiatus.
No, it started when Will Will was like, hey, by the way, we're going to go to you guys being on every other week.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That's not enough talking about.
Sorry, we were at a point where we were going to have like 6 people on per episode, and that's too much.
Neither.
Well, we don't blame you.
You called Second Sons. No one's mad at it. We were like, well, clearly.
So they made a different podcast.
Yeah, you know, speaking with specifically... your stuff not making a cast.
That whole section.
Yep. Well, the last time you described the origins of Second Sons, that made the episode. So don't feel too bad, Aaron.
I don't remember. Right.
I mean, at this point, it's mainly just entertaining to continue to remove every reference of Aaron.
It's just like, this episode is Will and Roy. Was Aaron here? Who knows? He said one thing that was appropriate in the 2 hours, so that's all. That
was kind of the goodbye to Luke episode. Yeah. So,
That actually made the episode.
There were a couple things of yours I cut, but I kept a lot more than normal.
Yeah, you definitely kept a lot. It was a good one.
Luke's mad at me.
Oh, is he still mad at you?
I don't know. I never messaged him about it because I've been busy. I probably should. He was in our testing group and he just kept whining. And I was like, quit your bitching. He just left the group. I was like, all right, well, whatever. If that's what it's going to take to hurt your feelings, man.
Oh, my.
Well, I miss Luke being on the show. So
we'll have to plan an excuse to get him back. He says that he misses casting. Well, we just need a topic that he can still jump in.
He's playing at Gen Con. He'll do our post Gen Con episode.
I still think we should do over the summer the theme episode where we talk about Aaron cannot be on this one, where we talk about the lore. I know Jesse is very excited about the idea of that, and I'm excited, and yeah. Luke would be a good one. Luke can be the Because Luke's hate of it is much more productive than Glazer's, so.
All right. Well.
And we will, unlike George R.R. Martin, close another chapter.
Yes. Of the well played, Aaron. Well played.
Thank you.
Right into the danger zone, Glazer. Right into the danger zone.